welcome you to the presentation of Dickinson College's annual Benjamin Rush Award for Humanistic Values in Corporate and Government Life. The award and lecture were established through the generosity of the late Wilbur M. Rabinowitz, a former trustee and member of the class of 1940. Each year since 1985, the college has presented an award in the memory and legacy of our founder, the esteemed Philadelphia physician, Dr. Benjamin Rush. And I might just add that there is a new development in the life, or shall we say the death, of Dr. Rush. Alumni have gotten together and we found a way to honor him at his gravesite. There is, as of yesterday, a beautiful bench near his grave at Arch and 4th in Philadelphia, and the bench has on it a plaque which thanks him for founding this college. So this is a totally new development. The purpose of this award is to recognize outstanding achievement in the field of business or government, and to honor an individual whose career has been distinguished by a commitment to the ideals and values of the liberal arts. There could be no greater tribute to honor and celebrate the intentions and convictions of Benjamin Rush, a revolutionary and signer of the Declaration of Independence. Rush was passionately committed to ensuring the success of the new democracy and the fledgling economy. Rush knew that the new nation could live up to its own expectations only if it was inhabited by citizens and leaders educated through an approach to the liberal arts that was distinctively American. It was for this express reason that Rush founded our college, Dickinson. Rush advanced a liberal education that would be useful and applicable to all professions. For Rush, commerce and manufacturing were defining and integral components of the new democracy, and he was determined that his vision, again this distinctively American vision, would provide the intellectual capital necessary to allow the emerging nation to excel in these areas. In fact, Rush expected more from Dickinson students than mere mastery of subject matter. A true Dickinsonian engaged the world in every sense of the phrase. From the outset, students were encouraged to venture beyond these limestone walls to explore all opportunities and avenues to apply their liberal arts education. Through early debating societies, students passionately considered all sides of emerging political and economic policies to arrive at reasoned, thoughtful, and ethical solutions that would advance humanity. Finally, students were expected to give voice to their positions as committed and active citizens. Dickinson students, in other words, were expected to be at the very forefront of public discourse, expressing their well-crafted opinions in the media, in government, and in their professions. Always ahead of his time, Rush's ambitions for Dickinson students extended well beyond Carlisle. Indeed, he envisioned Dickinson as a key feeder college, one of four, for a national university designed specifically to prepare the leaders of the new democratic nation. How interesting and gratifying to those of us who wear Rush's mantle so proudly that the idea of a U.S. public service academy resembling West Point or Annapolis or the Coast Guard Academy or the Air Force Academy. This new academy dedicated to developing, and I quote, students who pursue the highest ideals of human character and the values of freedom, democracy, and equal opportunity is now attracting increasing attention in our nation's capital. There is, in fact, a bipartisan suggestion that there be a national academy for public service. Rush's vision and legacy continue to guide Dickinson College today. We continue to maintain that a liberal arts education is the best preparation an individual can have for any profession. We continue to consciously integrate preparation for all careers throughout our curriculum, and we continue to strive to prepare our students to become the leaders of our communities, our country, and our world by encouraging them to use their voice constructively and persuasively to shape the policies, systems, and ideas that will advance our society. Pursuit of the liberal arts, which contains those subjects that explore the fullest range of human thought, action, emotion, and character, was expressly intended by Dr. Rush as the most useful preparation for a life of accomplishment and leadership. This is the legacy we honor today as we present the Benjamin Rush Award. We can think of no better way to express our commitment to Dr. Rush's vision than by recognizing those who have demonstrated the value of these ideals through their own successful careers. It is now my distinct pleasure to turn over the podium to Abigail Welsford, who will introduce our speaker. Abby is currently a senior at Dickinson, majoring in English with a minor in Spanish. Abby has served as a student project manager at the Clark Forum and currently serves as a student project supervisor. During the summer of 2006, she interned at the Philadelphia Business Journal. And after she graduates in May, Abby plans to pursue a career in marketing or human resources in Philadelphia. And I trust will visit often and sit by the grave of Dr. Rush. Abby, please.
Thank you for the introduction, President Durden. Good evening. As President Durden said, I am Abby Walsford, and I am a student project supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of Dickinson College and the Clark Forum, I'd like to welcome you to this evening's program, The Future of Media. As technology advances, the media is presented with more and more ways to convey information to the public. In the past two centuries, we have seen modes of communication evolve from handwritten correspondence to telephone communication to email. Readily available internet access makes up-to-date news and information available at the touch of a button. Information is transmitted in seconds from one end of the globe to the other. With face-to-face and even verbal communication becoming obsolete, the question of how we will interact in the future requires an answer. With video conferencing, online classes, and online shopping, is there any need to leave the comfort of one's own home to have a career, obtain an education, or acquire basic necessities? Access to information is made available almost instantly after an event occurs via news broadcast and websites. This raises the question of whether or not laws impose restrictions on media broadcasts and coverage regarding what information is released. Stephen Adler has been involved in the media and has held a career in journalism for more than 20 years. He has been the editor-in-chief of Business Week since 2005. He began his career at the Tampa Times and the Tallahassee Democrat. Adler then went on to work at the American Lawyer, and during his time there was named a National Magazine Award finalist for his article on the Union Carbide accident. After leaving the American Lawyer, Adler joined the Wall Street Journal as the legal editor. While at the Wall Street Journal, Adler directed reporting teams, who went on to win three Pulitzer Prizes. Promoted to deputy managing editor in 2000, Adler helped to expand the Wall Street Journal on the internet and directed news coverage in the Daily Edition. Adler graduated in 1977 from Harvard College and received his Juris Doctorate in 1983 from Harvard Law School. Mr. Adler is the recipient of the 2008 Benjamin Rush Award. The award is named for the founder of Dickinson College and signer of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush. One of the most prestigious honors awarded to Dickinson, the Benjamin Rush Award is given annually to a member of the corporate or government world who has achieved the highest levels in their field. At this time, I would like to ask you that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this program is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming Mr. Stephen Adler.
Thank you very much, Abby. You've been a great host during my day at Dickinson today. Thank you, President Durden and faculty, staff, members, friends of Dickinson. I want to particularly thank Andrew Gardner, class of 2007, who's here today, who recommended me for this award. And he's here with his mother, and it's really nice to have friends in the room. It's also really, I think, very special for me to be back on a college campus and back on a campus that with a liberal arts tradition, because as I'll explain in my comments that follow, I really learned an enormous amount from my own liberal arts education that served me wonderfully in my career and also in my life. It's also a particular honor to be associated, even kind of fleetingly and in passing, with Dr. Benjamin Rush, who, as everybody said, has not only signed the Declaration of Independence and, more importantly, founded Dickinson College, But I've learned recently, fought for prison reform and against slavery, pioneered psychiatric treatments such as the use of Turkish opium for nervous disorders, and yes, and stood up for people's right to medical care regardless of social class. And President Durden will forgive me if I say that I did not learn that from my liberal arts education, but I got that in 5 minutes on Wikipedia. I say that because we will get to Wikipedia shortly in this conversation, because my topic is the ongoing communications revolution that's brought us Wikipedia, the user-generated encyclopedia, as well as Facebook, YouTube, MoveOn.org, WebMD, virtually the entire contents of world-class libraries and archives, a tremendous value. Internet pornography, on the other hand, of every conceivable sort, the text message, and, of course, businessweek.com. So I'm here to reflect as a journalist and also as the beneficiary of an education like yours on what we've gained from this revolution so far and also what we've lost, and suggest some challenges facing the college students' generation as you prepare to enter a professional workforce that has chained itself to its cell phones and its BlackBerries, and thus is committing to bring the boss on vacation with them. So all I can say is lucky you. Now, I don't particularly like speeches, and I especially don't like long speeches because I would call them old media. It's a so-called authority pushing information at you rather than having a give and take in an exchange. So what I propose doing is pushing a little information and then spending more time than perhaps usual on the give and take. So I've timed this down to less than 25 minutes, even though you're expecting 35 to 40. But I am hoping that we can have a good conversation, that, and I hope that some of the things I say will stimulate that conversation. Since I'm going to raise a lot of questions about the wisdom of where we're heading as we communicate more and more instantaneously and electronically, as Abby said, I want to start by assuring you that my publication, Business Week, is participating fully and eagerly in what I call the good parts of the communications revolution, and that's to our great benefit and also to the benefit of our readers. Our magazine now reaches 5 million people in print, 8 million a month on the internet, 1 million a month via podcasts. We have 1 million podcast downloads a month, 700,000 a week on television, and 1,000 more on mobile devices. So in just 3 years, we've gone from being a magazine with the obligatory online site that was sort of an adjunct to it to a multi-channel business information hub, and that's a big difference. Because of the communications revolution, we reach more people than we have at any time in our 77-year history. So when one of our reporters went to Africa recently for a story about business investment there, he came back not only with a cover story, but with a fascinating narrated slideshow where he both showed and told what he had seen there, and it added a lot of richness to what you otherwise could have gotten. He also produced a podcast that was downloaded tens of thousands of times on iTunes. And our weekly cover podcast is typically the most downloaded business podcast on iTunes. So a lot of people are experiencing us through that that method. The online version of the story drew dozens of reader comments. And 2 weeks later, those comments flowed back into the magazine in a section that we call Feedback, which captures the online conversation that's generated by our print stories. A lot of people call that liquid content. The content is now flowing back and forth between different delivery channels rather than belonging to one or the other. So our role now is to present both news and information, to push it out, and also to moderate an intelligent conversation about it. So again, please don't assume I'm a Luddite as I rant about some of the changes that have occurred and some of the things I don't like about them. Now, it's true that I began my love affair with the news business in an era with no personal computers, no internet, no email, and no cell phones. And at the time, I also had an 8 p.m. curfew. That's because my first journalism enterprise was as a very annoying 8-year-old as the writer of a one-page sheet called Stevens Neighborhood Journal. So I ran around the neighborhood with a notebook, looked for evidence of news, asked lots of questions, called a few friends on the phone, and typed up what I'd have to say are the pretty feeble results on mimeograph paper, which some of you know what it is and some of you don't, stuffed into a manual typewriter, which some of you know what it is and some of you don't. Then my father, who was a high school English teacher for 30 years in the New York City school system, would go into the office and run off about 50 copies of Stevens Neighborhood Journal. And then I'd bring it into my class the next day, and I like to say that's my first experience with public hatred of the press, because my classmates in third grade were not thrilled to read Stevens Neighborhood Journal, but they were required to. But I'd say the real breakthrough in my understanding of what I was doing and why occurred when I was at Harvard College in the mid-70s. And there I majored in social studies, which was an interdisciplinary concentration, which allowed you to craft a course of study from different social sciences. But the purpose was to create a unique but coherent course of study that would culminate in the senior thesis. So that's all well and good, but what I liked about it was you could change your mind as to what was a coherent course of study every single semester, which I did. So I could match, I could figure out what courses I wanted, and then I create a new coherent course of study, and that would be the subject. Needless to say, I never got to the part where I wrote a senior thesis, because I didn't. This was not what the department had in mind, but as far as I'm concerned, a loophole is a loophole. So that's what I did. But I knew I wasn't going into academics, and I suspected strongly, based on my experience since I was 8, that I was going to go into newspaper work. So I figured wide exposure to diverse issues and cultures would come in handy, and they certainly did. I studied East Asian history and society, which is definitely a plus in light of what has happened in the world since then. I studied U.S. intellectual history, American presidential politics with Doris Kearns, now Doris Kearns Goodwin, Middle Eastern archaeology, which was fascinating, romantic poetry, modern art. I'm sure you can find the common thread there. Russian literature, and my absolute favorite, primate behavior. So primate behavior introduced me to the evolutionary roots of human activity, and has stood me in good stead at encounters with all sorts of seemingly irrational activity. So how else to make sense of the current presidential campaign, the Super Bowl, neckties, religious cults, or how to be America's next top model? But what turned out to help me most as a journalist was immersion in the craft of disciplined thinking, which I know is what President Durden talks about a lot as well. From tough-minded professors, teaching assistants, and fellow students, I learned to be skeptical of bold assertions unless a close analysis of the facts bore them out. I learned to read carefully, to write clearly, I hope, and to give fair attribution to my sources. I learned to relish reasoned disagreement on complex issues, and to respect how nuanced so many of those issues are, from the Trojan War to the War on Terror. I learned to describe an opposing viewpoint accurately first, and then to try to use what I considered more relevant facts and more powerful arguments to tear it down. These lessons spring naturally and gloriously from the liberal arts tradition. In 1976, I brought these attitudes, plus what I think were a very ragged set of skills, to my first professional journalism job as a summer intern at Long Island's newspaper, Newsday. Now, technologically speaking, not a huge amount had changed in the editorial end of the business, at least, since the days of Stephen's Neighborhood Journal. My first big headline story was Vacationer Slain on St. Martin. It was dated July 9, 1976, page 4, bottom of the page, if you want to look it up. And it was a big, complicated, static-plagued ordeal just to call the Caribbean long distance. And I remember it took a number of efforts just to get through. To get background on what you all know is a Dutch-French island, I hunted up the newsroom's battered atlas and encyclopedia to see if other Long Islanders had been crime victims while on vacation recently. To get context, I slogged through dozens of overstuffed file folders in the newspaper's archives, and they had labels like crime and murder, and they were clips. They were hard copy clips stuffed into these file folders, and you'd just be looking for the possibility of finding a trend or at least finding an anecdote. To reach the bereaved family somewhere on the north shore of Long Island, I had to look in a dozen local phone books, and every newsroom had a whole wall, stacks of local phone books so that you could look up and find people, until I found several plausible listings, because you always found more than one. And then I had to call them one by one until I, you know, sadly found the right one, because you never really wanted to talk to the bereaved family, but I ultimately did. So then I typed my story in triplicate with carbon paper between each sheet on, again, a big manual typewriter. I stored my copy on a metal spike, which every desk in a newsroom had, and that was kind of your organizational principle. The stuff at the bottom was old, the stuff at the top was new. What else do you need to know? And I sent the finished version to Sylvan Fox and Herbie Wheeler, real names, who were two really ferocious old world, old school editors who were on the city desk. So they marked it up in blue pencil very heavily, because I was very new. They rolled it into a scroll. They stuck it in kind of a container and put it in a hydraulic tube that shot a copy around the newsroom. And this is 1976. I mean, I was an adult. And it whisked it to the next stage in the production process. Now, that's obviously pretty clunky, but the whole thing worked. And the next morning, delivery boys, and they were almost always boys at that time, were riding on bicycles all over Long Island, throwing this newspaper with my hot story on thousands of people's front lawns. So on the one hand, the process was slow, and you'd have to say kind of pathetic in retrospect. Today, what would I have done? I would have Googled St. Martin, and in about 2 seconds found a terrific portal called stmartin.com. Wikipedia would have served as a useful backup. I've done both of these things last week, so I know that's there. I would have done a Google or a NexusLexis search for related incidents. I would have found them or not. If I'd happened to be interested in something broader, let's say relative safety of all the different Caribbean islands, or I got bored and I wanted to find the best beaches in the world, again, I could have found them almost instantaneously on the web in a matter of minutes. Getting phone numbers on Long Island, calling or emailing St. Martin, would all have been a few clicks away. I draft the whole story a lot faster on Microsoft Word or another word processing system without all the crossouts and arrows and complications of correcting copy on a typed piece of paper on deadline. The editing system would send the story electronically into the publishing and printing systems, which would produce the magazine and the online version, and the online version would be up in a matter of minutes to the online reader. If it was a big enough story, a news alert would have gone out on mobile devices. And perhaps I would have thrown together a quick video that I could have linked to on the online site. If readers wanted to comment, they could have done so online instead of writing a letter and waiting to see if an editor deemed it important enough to put in the magazine. The communications revolution has thus lowered the cost, accelerated the pace, and increased the amount and breadth of information available both to the reporter and to the end user. Now, there's nothing wrong, obviously, with any of that, as long as I performed my craft honestly and well, and as long as I had Sylvan and Herbie, the two editors on the City Desk and Newsday, to take the following steps in the liberal arts tradition. Make sure I verified the information on stmartin.com and on user-generated Wikipedia, rather than assuming it was true because it appeared on the web. Make sure I checked the spelling of the deceased person's name, because when you go on the web and you type in a name, you almost always find it because it's misspelled somewhere between 5 and 50 times on the web, and so you can't tell if it's spelled right. So they would have to make sure I checked. Make sure I called the hospital in St. Martin to double-check that the police report, which I had seen, also jibed with the hospital's report. Make sure I tracked down the lawyer for the drunk local kid who was picked up for the crime and heard his side of the story. Make sure after I'd done that, that I'd gone back to the police to question how this guy could have committed the crime if he had a pretty good alibi that he was on the other side of the island at the time. And make sure I identified myself at all times as a Newsday reporter instead, as some people have been known to do, as a friend seeking information. And make sure I told the story fairly, assuming nothing I didn't know for sure, presuming the innocence of the accused, and avoiding scaremongering about machete-wielding Caribbean locals attacking tourists. Now, the Florida tourism officials would have loved it, but it was not supported by the very thin set of facts. The routine but stern enforcement of these rules allowed readers to rely at least with some degree of certainty on the accuracy of a story in a reputable publication. And it allowed me and others who made journalism our profession to hold our heads up high and believe that what we did was valuable and sometimes perhaps even noble. Time spent reading what washes up on the internet can be a wonderful learning experience, but unfortunately, tolerance, discipline, grace, and rigor are not among the lessons it teaches. The more traditional journalistic approach, regardless of delivery channel, and it's fine if it's delivered on the internet, is widely dismissed by many people these days and sometimes even ridiculed. And that happened most recently and most publicly with the New York Times' recent front page story suggesting that John McCain may have been having an affair with a lobbyist and that he'd done unfair advantages for her client. Now, that reporting may or may not hold up. It certainly doesn't look like it's going to. But it's also true that that kind of disciplined professional journalism brought us the investigative reporting that uncovered the Pentagon Papers and blew the lid off Watergate in the 1970s, bringing down a corrupt president. At great risk, such reporting during the current decade unmasked corruption and murder in Russia, human rights violations in Burma and China, and the U.S. use of secret overseas prisons in the war on terror. So in my own career as an investigative editor, at the Wall Street Journal, this kind of reporting discipline by other people, by reporters, uncovered internal documents that proved that one tobacco company was intentionally increasing the potency of the cigarettes to make people more addicted, and that had lied about it. And this reporting led to a multi-billion-dollar settlement with the tobacco companies and really changed the way tobacco was thought of and used in America. Also, reporters who I worked with at the Journal shone a light on two U.S. researchers who had been chemically sterilizing women in the Third World because it turned out they didn't think there should be so much immigration from the Third World to the United States, and the women often didn't know that that was what was happening and was certainly against their will, caused an enormous worldwide explosion, and our reporting put an end to that practice. There's something good about the discipline of this traditional kind of reporting. This, too, is how we still do business at Business Week, although our approach, I believe, is increasingly rare, and it's increasingly financially challenged. We have written guidelines, which we hold ourselves to, and they're public. They sound obvious, but when you think about what appears on the net, ask yourself whether people are going through this thought process before they post. We must start with accurate information, honestly and professionally gathered. Moreover, our interpretation must flow from the facts and be reasonable. All our dealings with sources and with other editorial staff must be truthful. We give the subjects of a story an opportunity to have their views presented. If someone complains about a story, we investigate promptly and even-handedly. We always strive to be fair. In contrast, and now comes the dark side, do a Google search for, quote, Obama is a Muslim, end quote, and you get 83,600 hits. Now, many thousands of these items, not all of them, some of them are discussing it, but many thousands of these items assert definitively that he is, even though he isn't. And they offer third-hand evidence to prove this falsehood. I tried to find another one that wasn't too offensive. I came up with the term, the Yankees suck, okay? That net almost 400,000 hits. And frankly, as a Yankee fan, I consider that an absolute outrage. But, I mean, seriously, anybody can say anything on the web and communicate it globally and instantly. Well-trafficked websites and blogs post all sorts of truly toxic content and the thousands of anonymous and virulent comments that follow after it. Sure, it's great that technology has empowered the individual to speak his or her own mind without any need for a publishing intermediary. But try writing intelligently these days about immigration. And get ready for profanity and even death threats from the angry mob at the computer. Run afoul of a colleague or an employee and see how quickly some scurrilous and invariably false allegation finds its way onto a web page that's devoted to printing gossip about your particular industry. In a world without editors, bloggers almost never call for comment. They publish attacks first, and then they let the victims dignify the falsehoods by responding or just let them proliferate on the web and be there anytime a friend, a colleague, a future employer decides to Google your name. Anyone in a remotely prominent position in government, entertainment, business, the media, or I'd say academia will tell you the same thing. Without a set of traditions and rules, without a belief system that values accuracy and fairness, primate behavior, my favorite subject in college, takes over. And that can be blatantly tribal, xenophobic, self-aggrandizing, predatory, and just plain mean-spirited. I had a recent Dickinson graduate read this, and she said, wait a minute, you should talk about the community-building aspects of primate behavior as well. I think that came from her strong humanistic Dickinson education. So I should add that a more positive characteristic of primate behavior is the desire to create communities, and that's true. And at its best, the web's a wonderful tool to nurture informed and supportive communities. So we can just focus on the positive and ignore the venom and the drivel, the voyeuristic videos and the inaccurate information, plus the websites that do nothing but aggregate the junk that other people produce, and everybody makes money undoing it. But sadly, if you're in the media business, you cannot, because you're now competing with just about all of it. Here's why. If you believe professional reporters who follow a set of rules are more likely to get fair and accurate information than somebody who doesn't, you've got to pay them. And generally speaking, you have to pay them a decent amount. Blogosphere commentary typically is free of cost. It just goes up. If you think it's important to send trained professionals into war zones, as we and all other traditional media have, you have to be prepared both for the cost of that and the danger. If you believe that skilled editors who can pick apart a story for logical flaws, ethical lapses, and even grammatical offenses benefit the reader, you have to pay for these wordsmiths. But the communications revolution that's created a torrent of electronic information has also created the convention that web content, especially news and information, is supposed to be free to the user. It's also created the convention that it's acceptable to share other people's web content through links and through aggregation sites such as Dig.com, The Huffington Post, and Google News, usually without paying the content's original creators. But users storm through so many websites in a given day. Actually, our Business Week readers read 21 different business websites during the course of a week. I mean, it's just crazy. That few really differentiate much between people who have spent a ton of money to develop reliable content and those that are repeating rumors or repurposing other people's work. Research we've done showed that convenience of use scores much, much higher than quality of content in people who use the web to get information. Now, you can try to charge for higher quality work, and a very few organizations with very specialized content, like Consumer Reports, have succeeded in doing so. But by and large, attempts to charge for information on the web have failed. So the people who run websites typically have to make their money by selling advertising to companies that want to reach their users. But there's so much content on the web, almost infinite, where space is never an issue, that ad rates are quite low, and quality content matters less than the advertiser's ability to precisely target the users that they want. Google text ads find the user when he or she is searching for a car or trying to purchase a home or a computer and get related products right in front of them at the time that they're thinking of buying. The consumer's buying proclivities, as shown by where he or she surfaces on the web, get turned into cash. People used to say that content was king, but arguably in this commercial electronic world, it's been dethroned. So organizations like Business Week, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, CBS, NBC, don't get paid all that much for the expensive, heavily researched work that we post on the web, not compared to what advertisers paid us when newspapers and magazines dominated the media landscape, along with network TV, and the internet did not exist. Under the circumstances, more and more organizations are cutting costs by reducing the number of reporters in places like China, Russia, and Africa, and reducing editors in the newsroom, the Sylvans and the Herbies, and thus minimizing the validity and reliability of what's produced. Now, you, the consumer of all this, can try to ignore the dumb stuff and rely on what's left of intelligent reporting and commentary, but you'll get less and less of it as time goes by if current trends continue. Fortunately, I believe my corner of the news business, business news, has the best chance of slowing or even reversing these trends. I'm not saying it'll be easy, but as Senator Obama would say, there's nothing false about hope. So my hope derives from the fact that money is at stake when business readers consume business information. If we're wrong about the length of the housing slowdown or the depth of a recession or the scope of business opportunities, say, in Eastern Europe or Central America, readers who rely on us will lose money. If we're careful, smart, dispassionate, and reliable, they can act on what they read in Business Week and live to tell the tale. The fact that there are concrete consequences to whether we get it right or wrong and whether we offer smart or careless analysis should mean that readers will value our content more highly than something they run across on a blog or on Wikipedia. If readers value our work more highly, presumably they'll pay more to receive it, at least in print. And already we're seeing that we're able to charge more for our magazine than many of our competitors. We've just done a competitive analysis. We've kept our average charge that we charge people the same, and the other our competitors have come down. So it suggests that people are valuing what we're paying to do. Online, we're also counting on web users to start differentiating more among business sites, among the 21 they're currently using, as they develop clearer ideas about where the most reliable information resides. And our growth on the web, roughly triple the usage we had 3 years ago, suggests this may be starting to happen. And when we get more users, we make more money, so that does work as a business plan. Now, if it can happen in business, perhaps it will spread to politics, global news, and even entertainment. Sure, primate behavior will always enter the picture, and gossip and innuendo will always appeal. But if my profession is going to survive and maybe thrive, is going to have to penetrate our primate skulls that reliable information, professionally gathered and honestly delivered in the liberal arts tradition, is essential to a strong economy and to a thriving democracy. I should note that while a lot of the political commentary on the web is pretty mindless and sometimes quite offensive, the internet has had a largely positive impact, in my opinion, on the political campaigns themselves. Each day I get an email from Hillary Clinton. I haven't contributed to her campaign, but Hillary, Bill, or Chelsea email me every single day for a nice, cozy update on how they're doing. And that's a way of communicating that certainly didn't exist before. And by the way, they always spell my name right, which is kind of cool. Senator Obama's campaign announced recently it raised $32 million in January, 90% of it online. But it's not just the money, it's also the message. Online organizations such as MoveOn.org, with more than 3 million members, have had tremendous impact on campaigning. And so has that YouTube Yes We Can music video, which now boasts the biggest ever audience for a political speech, 13 million and counting. That's where a music group put the music alongside the words of his Yes We Can speech, and everybody's sharing it on the internet. Technology has enabled politicians and campaigners to talk and talk back at very little cost in a way that they couldn't before. So one final thought on those BlackBerries that may soon be buzzing in your ear day and night, Andrew, because they are another transformative product of the communications revolution. Now, I love my BlackBerry because it was the only communications device that worked on 9/11, and I was down at what's now Ground Zero on 9/11, and it was the only way I could communicate with my family. So I'm not suggesting, you know, that it's not a good thing, and I've saved all of those precious emails back and forth as I let people know I was okay. So certainly the availability of more communication tools at your fingertips and the ability to converse rapidly across the globe can, of course, be highly empowering. But in ordinary times, just because someone can reach you at 2 a.m. from an affiliate office in Beijing doesn't mean you should be available to be reached at 2 a.m. And just because it's more convenient to email a colleague than to walk to the next cubicle to talk to them doesn't mean email is the better alternative. And just because my BlackBerry now works on Martha's Vineyard, where I vacation, doesn't mean I should be fielding 50 emails a day rather than walking on the beach or picking real BlackBerries. But the conventions that have arisen around email and BlackBerries, essentially that we're on all the time because they are, can really destroy one's productivity, one's peace of mind, and one's family life. My generation, caught up in the newness of the technology, has really bungled its use. I strongly suggest that yours lay down some rules to make instant communications serve you rather than vice versa. So now I want to know what you think. Does the liberal arts tradition that we share have any relevance to the future of media and communication? I'll throw out a few questions, but you'll have your own. Am I a hopeless antiquarian? We could talk 10 minutes about that. Is my profession or my idea of it doomed? Does it make sense? Do you think the vitality of the debate on the web illuminates more than it obscures? How do you know what information to trust and what not to? And I guess I'd wonder whether younger minds are just so much better at multitasking and dealing with the text messaging on top of the video watching that perhaps they don't see it as a burden. So now it's your turn. What do you think? Looking forward to having a good conversation about all of this. Who's got something they want to ask or say? Okay, President Durden. Yeah.
Thank you. Let me take another liberal arts perspective on this historical one. And your argument is very solid, except someone might look at this historically and say, oh, wait a minute. 18th century was filled with horrible journalism, and there were all sorts of scurrilous comments made. Have we always historically fought this imbalance or between reason and unreason, and we just happen to be living now and experiencing the unreason of our time? Or do you really believe this is an accelerated situation because of the internet?
I guess I think both things are true. I think that, in a sense, we went from disintermediation to intermediation back to disintermediation, in a sense, because it was apparently quite easy to put out a pamphlet. I don't think you had to have a huge amount of money and a great relationship with a publisher. So I do think some of that 18th century pamphleteering was, in some respects, not that different. On the other hand, it wasn't global. Generally speaking, somebody had to really want to do it. they had to at least put a lot of effort into it and a lot of thought into it. It took some doing, at least, to get it out and to get it up on placards. One of the things that's wrong with what currently goes on is it's so casual, and it's so mean-spirited, and it's anonymous. Now, I know there were sometimes anonymous pamphleteers, but I think the piling on and the number of people who can come on to a conversation about immigration, when we redesigned our magazine, which I think was a good redesign, and has the overall public response has been positive, but whenever you do something like that, you're going to get some negative reaction from people who don't want you to change anything. The negative reaction we got was, you should lose your job, you should never have been in this business, you're the stupidest person in the world, how could you do this to me? The level of discourse has become so low, and what's acceptable on the web is so uncivil that I do think something different has happened because of the speed, the anonymity, the global nature, and the sense of entitlement that everybody says everybody's opinion is as good as everybody else's. But I take your point that it was also going on kind of before big media took over the tools of distribution. Is it true? Other thoughts? Yes.
Is it too late to go back to even a code of ethics or etiquette for electronic communication? Or has it moved so far ahead so fast that we're already past that? Because legal things have tried to catch up.
Yeah.
But I don't think the ethical things or the etiquette, the simple, you know, who do you forward to and what do you say?
Well, I mean, the problem for me is, I don't believe in regulation of media. So I don't, occasionally people say, the press is irresponsible, there should be some sort of neutral body, judging whether stories are correct or not. All those kinds of, or that the profession itself should set up a set of rules. And I viscerally don't think that's a good idea because I think you start down a road towards censorship, ultimately. So then the question is, can you codify civility? And I don't think so. Can you teach it? Yes, in a liberal arts institution, you can teach it. You could talk about it. You could make it more part of a high school or a junior high school curriculum. And you can decide that the discourse in society is going so low that it's actually hurting the democracy, and you can make an issue of it in a broad way. I don't think anybody's ready to do that. But it wouldn't hurt. Whether it would have a big impact, it's so cultural at this point. People don't turn away from it is the interesting thing. And you're tempted, and everybody is. I mean, there are publications that are tabloid publications that I know I shouldn't believe, that I don't like, I don't believe in, and I don't respect. And I tend to read them until they say something about me or somebody I know personally. And then I boycott them for a while because I think it's an outrage. And so right now I'm not reading the New York Post. But I'll come back to it because I enjoy it, and I think it's very difficult to fight, again, primate behavior, the salacious desire, the desire to read bad things about other people, to read gossip. But I do think this technology has facilitated and a culture has built around it that is harmful in that respect. Go ahead, Mike.
Just a kind of quick question. At what point do you think we're going to reach a kind of media saturation or information saturation?
Yeah.
And if we do, because there's so much of it,
yeah.
At what point is there going to be some sort of backlash against it, which is even as equally dangerous, I think?
Well, I mean, we actually wrote a column recently on the notion of scarcity, that there's starting to be scarcity of time, that just who's got the time to do all this stuff? People keep building they keep having new media projects, new internet projects. They're starting new things. And you go, well, you only have 24 hours in a day no matter how much you're multitasking. So to some degree, the growth has to run down. We're also seeing a very bad year in growth of internet advertising, and we're not sure what that's about, but it might be some sort of sense that some of the flow towards that was excessive or not as effective way to communicate with people as more traditional ways. One big advertiser, Dell, has made a big push back into print. And that's surprising because it's a tech advertiser, and most tech advertisers are saying that all the action's on the web. But they've been doing huge campaigns with a large number of publications, including us, which suggests to me that some people are thinking a little differently about it. And at least in a commercial sense, that seems to be a backlash. Whether there's a cultural backlash, I'm not sure. I'm just going to get water.
Hi. Overall, I think you've mentioned a few good things, speed,
right,
easy access to information, but overall I think you've glorified maybe the traditional print journalism and really vilified the new media's blogging, podcasts. Mm-hmm. What do you say in cases like post 9/11 New York Times, which is widely regarded as some of the greatest failings of modern media when basically they became a spokesperson for the White House? How do you see the role of blogging as maybe being a check on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I suggested, the traditional media using the traditional rules often messes up. And the current McCain thing might be an example. A lot of people think the weapons of mass destruction stuff after 9/11 in the Times convinced a lot of people that Iraq had those weapons and that that was really faulty reporting. I think somebody would have had to have real knowledge and access to the information, which is very difficult to get sitting there blogging. So it's not a question of expressing opinion. I wasn't that interested in people expressing the opinion that the Times is a tool of the government. I wanted the facts. I wanted somebody who actually knew what was going on. And I think that required a more traditional model of somebody who's skilled in the tasks of ferreting out hard-to-get information. That's what I'm standing up for. It's not the print medium. And that could be done online, and good stuff happens online. I'm not rejecting the technology. I'm rejecting a culture around the notion that traditional ways of thinking hard about how to get information, checking it, fact-checking it, trying to figure out whether it's true, is something that has been largely kind of passed by people who are, really into the whole blogosphere. I read some interesting commentary on blogs, but I haven't learned a lot of new facts on blogs, and I learn a lot of facts in newspapers and on newspaper websites. So,
isn't a large part of the failure with information actual bounded rationality and inability to process large amounts of information? And that's just getting worse as we...
I'm sorry, the failure of... I'm having trouble hearing.
Failure of the ability to process the information. I mean, if you think about the failure that occurred with weapons of mass destruction, that had to do with senators not going into the room and reading the damn stuff that they were given in behind closed doors that they had access to, and only a small percentage of the senators actually doing the reading.
Well, I mean, a lot of useful, good information exists, and part of it has to do with how people choose to consume it. I certainly agree with you on that. But I think we're living in a world where there's a huge amount of noise, so it's very hard to sort out what's important and what's not, what's factual and what's not. And again, I don't want to turn back the clock on technology. You never can, but you have to learn how to manage it. And to me, a good example is walking past a TV that's on all the time in my office and in the office building and everywhere. And it's all usually on CNN, and it always says breaking news, always. I mean, right? And somebody's always speaking in an extremely anxious and overblown way. And John Stewart does a great job, shooting you a whole bunch of different examples of it in a row. But often it's of something of absolutely no significance, but you go through your life, and if you're on the web, the same thing happens. If you're on Drudge or if you're any number of different places, there's always stuff going around, and there's so much stuff, there's so much noise, there's so much confusion, there's so many rumors that it does become hard to stop and focus and say, okay, here are the things that are important for me to concentrate on, and here are the sources that will help me concentrate on them effectively, and let me put those two things together to become well-informed. Instead, you go to 21 different places, and you don't get 21 times the knowledge, understanding, and information. So it has an enormous amount to do with how people absorb the information, but that's part of the broader, I think, impact of the technology revolution, is that we're living in that sped-up world, and that there are some real negative consequences to that.
You talk about the effect of multitasking and too much information on the news consumer. What about your journalists who now are not only having to write cover stories, but put together slideshows and videos? And how are your journalists handling?
Sounds like you spent time in the newsroom lately. it's hard. I mean, again, it's not. I don't think it's. In some ways, it's really positive. In some ways, it's positive because you're telling stories in different ways, and storytelling is what we're trying to do. So if, in fact, for example, you can go to Africa, take photographs, bring them back, narrate a slideshow that helps people understand what you saw and what it meant to you, that's kind of cool, and that didn't really exist before. So I think that's a good thing. And a lot of people writing in newsrooms also are kind of excited about the interactivity of the web. So they'll do a blog post or they'll do a story on the web, and they'll get much more immediate contact with their readers and much more of a sense that they're engaging in a dialogue, assuming the dialogue is reasonably civilized. So I think they see certain advantages, but I have absolutely no doubt that people are not concentrating as hard on each individual task, that they're working way more hours. We pretend they're not, but they are, because there's no way to do all of this. Everybody's cutting staff while increasing the amount of work people have to do by making them work on multiple platforms. If everybody was making more money, frankly, then you'd hire enough staff so that they could do it, but do it at a pace that was more manageable. What I found at the Wall Street Journal that was very disturbing, it used to be you would spend all day working on the story that had broken during the day so you could write the best possible story for your readers in the morning. Now what you do is you have to file for the European edition by 2 and the Asian edition by 4, and you have to be also filing for the website, and the web editor is harassing you to do that. So when do you do the reporting and, more importantly, the thinking that creates the great story that is what you're supposed to be doing if you're at the Wall Street Journal? So everybody complains about it, and I think it is a real problem, absolutely. The only problem is, what's the way out of it? You can't walk away from the web because it's the only growth area we've got. And you could separate the people doing the two things, but then you're duplicating the reporting and the thinking on the topic, so you want to try to bring it together because resources are scarce. You also don't want people tripping over each other. So I don't think it's something that people have found a solution to. I think journalists, frankly, are scared enough of losing their jobs that to some degree they accept the speed up and they just do it. But it's a great question.
I know that when I sit down to read a magazine, my reading habits and the way I interact with the content are a lot different from when I click on a story on my Business Week iGoogle widget, for example. Mm-hmm. Do you take any steps to address the difference in I guess, user participation and the way that your readers or users interact with the content at Business Week?
Well, most of BusinessWeek.com is not the magazine content. We have a channel that's the magazine content. And while there's an opportunity to provide reader comments on those stories, that's basically taking the magazine, putting it online, and by the way, it's free, and you can look at 5 o'clock on Thursday afternoons, you can basically read the magazine online. But most of the website isn't that. Most of the website is much more contemporary. It's management case studies that you can interact with. It's blogs that we do, but we think we do responsibly, and an opportunity to engage with the writer on that. It's shorter items that are more user-friendly for the web. We write different headlines for the web, in part because people read it differently, and in part because we want the search engines to capture the keywords and take people to the site. So increasingly, it's quite a different animal that lives by different rules. You post little videos with the story. Sometimes you do videos as the main item. So again, we went from being a magazine that was also doing a website to having some web expertise and some web sophistication and producing something that actually is a website. It's not a magazine on the web. The only thing that is the magazine channel. And that's evolving, and we're going to be doing more and more social networking type of stuff and interactivity as our tools get better. But it's definitely the aspiration to have a very different product.
This is more an observation than a question. I'm always amazed by, you were talking about the various platforms for information dissemination. Mm-hmm. It seems to me now that people kind of craft storylines and that really these platforms have created this big gap as far as creating content. And so you really have this difficulty in figuring out what is truly information and what really is kind of constructed storylines that people were trying to kind of backfill into. So they create a storyline and then find ways to create urgency around that, and then again, this is an observation, and then the difficulty of the reader of really separating what's entertainment from true information. I mean, it just drives me crazy, you know, trying to get at true storylines, and it seems this urgency to get information out rather than to kind of fact check or to build a good story is really this sense of, you know, that the value is getting out quick rather than getting out accurately.
Yeah. And again, unfortunately, when you survey readers and users, they seem to be reflecting that. They seem to be asking for very convenient access, very fast, and not caring as much. That's what they're telling us. I don't know if it's true. Not caring as much about the quality of the content. I think brands are a way to protect against that, but brands, in many cases, have gotten weaker on the web. And we're hoping, as a legacy media company, that people will say, okay, that's a brand that I can trust. The Wall Street Journal is a brand I can trust. Maybe the New York Times is a brand you can trust. Maybe somebody else comes along who's even specific to the web who's a brand you can trust. But that might be a way that people start sorting and differentiating, but it isn't how they're using the web now. They're going to search engines, they're searching what they're looking for, or they're getting involved in the blog community and they're participating through Technorati and other things in blog searches. By and large, I think the web use is moving away from portals, it's moving away from brands, and much more towards search. And when you're focusing on search, then you're not necessarily going to get the most reliable content at the top. You're going to get the people who have maximized their search engine optimization and have either done the payments or they're clever about the words they use so that their content surfaces.
In other words, okay, we're going to create, you know, a perception of the future and then backfill into it. That just makes me crazy.
Well, makes me crazy too.
Would you like to weigh in on who owns that liquid content you were talking about?
Who owns it? Well, it depends on how it's being created. If it's, in other words, the content that involves the conversation on the web.
Yes, the conversation on the web that then ends up in your
program. Well, we think we own it. Who do you think owns it?
Well, you didn't make the story happen, but you get to write about it and then sell that content. They didn't make your story happen, but they get to write about it. Do they get paid for it?
No, they're, generally speaking, they're posting. I mean, we're taking their postings that they have posted on our site. We've offered them to participate in the Business Week brand by coming onto our site and having their comments posted as part of our brand. They didn't ask to get paid for it. They just participated and they posted it. But, you know, I like the point because I think it is a good point. Everybody's trying to make the most of this medium. The medium is heavily around aggregation, aggregating content you didn't create that you can monetize. And I think we certainly do it less than other people do because we spend, you know, a vast sum of money creating our own content and paying tons of people to do it. But yes, not every piece of content that we monetize did we create. You're absolutely right.
You don't have a little checkbox next to it. I give away all my rights to this comment I'm about to give to Business Week.
Well, you're making a good point. I think it's implied that if somebody voluntarily posts something on your site, that you can use it. If they wanted to get paid, you know, they would find a way to communicate that with you. But if they want to post it, clearly the terms in which they're posting it is that it's free. It's a good rejoinder, and I think you do have a point. But I would say the costs we incur. The many, many, many tens of millions of dollars we incur to have reporters out all over the world creating content is something that's of value, and we need to be able to make enough money to be able to support that. And is it unethical for us to use the work of the public that they bring onto our site? I don't think it is, but I respect your right to think it is. I do think there's an ambiguity there.
First of all, I want to say that I don't envy you your job, especially in this day and age where there's a lot of choices of where you're going to get your business content. And I think it is critical that you maintain the trust with America, that's probably critical to your survival at Business Week. Having said that, I'd be interested to know how your revenue stream comes in. And first of all, because I download your podcast, your cover story podcast, I believe you're the voice of that.
No, it's my colleague John Byrne.
Is it? Okay. Yeah. You sound just like him. In any case, I think it's a wonderful start to that podcast and an introduction to the cover story. And this is not a paid political
But you're absolutely right. So yeah.
In any case, as you see your future here, your revenue stream now coming from print podcast, I download that podcast and it all happens automatically. So in those numbers that you mentioned, there's millions of podcast downloads you counted. Sometimes I listen to them.
Yeah.
Sometimes
Fair
I don't.
Enough. Fair enough.
And I probably listen to more than 50% of them, but it probably still counts as a download because it updates it automatically. And then you also have web content. How much of your revenue is separated between podcasts going actually onto the web and then your magazine itself?
Okay. I'm a little confused about how proprietary this is because I've heard people talk about it publicly and then I've heard them say it's not public. Let me just tell you very roughly, and don't hold me to this, roughly 60% of our revenue comes from print advertising, roughly 20% comes from online, including podcasts, and roughly 20% comes from circulation revenue. And that's very high for our industry, but it's way too low for our needs because the world's just moving too fast. The podcasts right now, I believe, are sponsorships for which we get a set amount of money, so I don't think we're having to count how many people actually view it. I mean, obviously, the advertiser has a sense of how many downloads there are, and you know, it's not we don't get paid that much for them. They're like $10,000 or $15,000 to sponsor a podcast, I think, for a year. So, podcasts right now are not a major revenue source. But what we're hoping is, it sometimes helps close a deal. So, in combination with offering them a print ad campaign, an online ad campaign, something on the TV shows, something on online videos, maybe sometimes if you throw in the cover podcast or the Jack and Susie Welch podcast, that closes the deal. So sometimes it's not the amount of money, but the ability to do the deal that makes it valuable.
Thank you very much for your comments. I've really enjoyed them.
My pleasure.
I've heard you say throughout your question and answer period that costs are a problem. Mm-hmm. And then building on this gentleman's questions regarding revenue, I have taken a number of your courses on how to use, for example, cameras, some of these Business Week courses that you have mm-hmm. right on the net. Mm-hmm. I've also seen some of the active case management types of activities that you have. Mm-hmm. And I've been following with great interest what the Washington Post is doing with the biggest margin in their pool of firms, and that happens to be their for-profit educational facilities. Yes. I wonder if anytime soon Business Week intends to replace my alma mater, the University of Chicago Business School.
I was involved at the Journal and looking at whether we could do a Wall Street Journal branded business program, and I just didn't think it really worked. I think there's something in common in the two ways of thinking, but I don't think they bring enough to each other to be worth pulling together, except kind of as a branding gimmick. And frankly, I don't think Business Week is an academic brand, so I'm not sure it gains much. Now, the Washington Post has Kaplan because they bought Kaplan, and it's a unit of the Washington Post company, and it's by far the most profitable thing they do, and they'd be in real trouble if they didn't have it. Our parent company is McGraw-Hill, and it has the giant McGraw-Hill book publishing and education division, and that's sort of there's three legs of the stool. The other one is the financial services part, which up until last July was by far the most profitable. Standard & Poor's was the main part of it, and that was a juggernaut until the credit crunch and all the blame and finger-pointing that's resulted. And then we have a media division in which we're a piece. So the goal of the company is to have a portfolio of companies, some of which are counter-cyclicals, some of which have very solid seasons, which are based on other things. Texas is an enormous adoption state where you're waiting to see which textbooks they're going to adopt. And so there's a big campaign around getting Texas to adopt your textbooks, which is a completely different proposition from Who Wants to Advertise in Business Week this week. So we do try to have a balanced portfolio, and we do have some of the virtues of a Kaplan in our McGraw-Hill textbook division. But, you know, we're kind of a small piece of this larger company. But I think what a lot of companies are finding is if they want to do media, they've got to sort of make it a small piece because it's not, you know, a great business right now. Or you've got to do something different. And I'm not saying even this different thing might not be the future. And that might be you decide it's a public service. And maybe it's a philanthropic service. Maybe it's some sort of public service. I think the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg owns the St. Petersburg Times, so they're in a slightly different situation. And my former boss, Paul Steiger, who was managing editor of the Wall Street Journal, has just started something called ProPublica. And he's got charitable money, $10 million a year, to put together an investigative reporting team. And he's got 24 slots to hire people to do essentially freelance investigative reporting and then pitch it to publications. So that's saying, okay, this is a value. Somebody wants to pay for it because they think it's a value rather than whether you're going to make a business out of it. I'm not sure that's a final, you know, a great solution for media in this country altogether, but in pockets it might actually be helpful.
Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question.
This takes the focus a little in a little different direction, but relates somewhat to the Union Carbide business.
Uh-huh.
There was the story where in this small town there was a freight wreckage with toxic loads on the in the freight, which escaped. And the town's radio station was automated because it was owned by something a little large like Clear Channel
right.
and so forth. So there was no one there. And so the local people had no way of knowing anything about what was going on. And I was wondering, I would figure you as an individual would be very aware of this. And I was wondering if you knew where things went with this, because this is a part of communication that has gone out the window along with a load of the 1934 FCC charter regulations, which have gone with the wind to a great extent. And I'd be thankful if you'd comment on that.
Well, I mean, I take your point on radio that when you had more of a requirement that communities be served locally, which I think you used to have, right, then you were more likely to get served there. I think one of the, actually, I would argue that one of the virtues of blogging and the internet would be in a situation like that. I would put that on the plus side of the ledger. You may not have big media in the location, and while it would be great if big media saw something of importance and came in and covered it, probably that's not always going to happen because people are making choices, and that might be one that just slipped past people because they were focusing on other things. And that might be a situation where people going onto the internet locally would have had more of an impact on getting it out than relying on institutional media. And having both, I do think, is valuable. I think that the citizen journalism aspect of it is not necessarily a bad thing. What I worry about is that because of the business models, it basically subsumes everything else, and you no longer have people professionally gathering information. But if you don't have reporters on the scene with the skills to get the story out, that's definitely a loss of a public good, and it may be that the citizen journalist steps in there and helps. As to why any particular organization didn't do it, there's any number of reasons, it's probably because it somehow didn't get their attention, or it didn't get their attention enough, or they were focusing on something else, and it didn't happen, and often you need the local person to generate the interest in it. Thank you. Where do you want me?
Oh, you could be right there. That'd be fun, right over there.
Okay.
Mr. Adler, it gives me great pleasure, and thank you very much for a provocative presentation.
Thank you.
And I was thinking that some people might say that you are looking at perhaps the foe here, maybe the academy that introduced perhaps postmodernism and the idea that facts and truth are no longer privileged. Yet, in replacing that, we of course have now a very lively challenge and discussion in the academy where authority is not vested in one particular area, and so we must challenge each other, and all authorities must always be questioned, and that's an interesting replacement. It gives me great pleasure to present you with the 2008 Benjamin Rush Award in recognition of your outstanding commitment to excellence in journalism and the invaluable contributions you have made to enhance the world's awareness
of key global issues for your work as reporter and editor. And may I present this to you.
Thank you very much.
And Abby, do you like to come forward?
And on behalf of the Clark Forum, we'd like to also present you with a token of our appreciation for coming and being here with us tonight.
I walked over here. I didn't know there was something else. Thank you so much. Thank you, Abby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this concludes our presentation. Thank you all for attending.